The expression went viral in the 1960s, generation gap. Those in power at the time had fought in World War II. They were shocked to see college students in the U.S. rebel against the call to serve their country and go to war. How much has the current movement on college campuses exposed a new generation gap? Will the consequences be as long-reaching? For the first time since the Vietnam War, Columbia University invited police onto the New York City campus, this time to break up a pro-Palestinian encampment. That has since sparked sit-ins across the United States. We'll ask about, at minimum, a call for a ceasefire, for some, a boycott of Israel, like the 1980s movement to divest from apartheid-era South Africa. Will a seemingly endless war in Gaza wind up tearing apart the American left the way the Vietnam War did? And what about this side of the Atlantic? Students here, too, are divided. Many here also perceive Israel not as David, but as Goliath. How to address the legitimate fears felt by both Jews and Muslims that the eruption in the Middle East will only lead to a blurring of lines and unbridled intolerance that goes mainstream? Today in the France 24 debate, we're looking at the pro-Palestinian movement on campuses with the sociologist Gregory Smith-Simon, professor at Brooklyn College. Your latest book, Liberty Road, Black Middle-Class Suburbs and the Battle Between Civil Rights and Neoliberalism. Thanks for joining us.
Good evening, François.
Also with us, journalist Annette Lévy-Villard, former U.S. correspondent for the French daily newspaper Libération. You chronicled the 2006 Israel war with Lebanon in the in this book, Summer Rain. Thanks for joining us.
33 days in summertime. That was a French title.
That was the.
It lasted only 33 days compared to what goes on today, which is
almost more than
7 months.
Yeah. From New York City, political scientist Yasha Munk, author of The Identity Trap, A Story of Ideas and Power in Our Time. Thank you so much for being with us, Yasha.
It's my pleasure.
And from Atlanta, Georgia, Noah McAfee, chair of the philosophy department at Emory University. Welcome to the show.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Let's begin with your story. Last Thursday in Atlanta, on the campus of your university, several dozen students arrested after protesters began erecting a tent encampment. Activists accused police of unnecessarily using tear gas and tasers. And among those arrested, well, we can show the images now. There was you. There you are. Let's take a listen.
I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. Is there anything I can do for you right now?
Can you call the philosophy department office and tell them I've been arrested?
Philosophy department?
Yes. Call the philosophy department office.
I will. I will. What's your?
I'm Noel McAfee. I'm chair of the philosophy department.
I got you.
President-elect.
I got you.
Noel McAfee, tell us, those images are quite startling. What happened exactly that day? Why were the police so heavy-handed?
And then they came for the intellectuals, sort of. I think that the message that came to the administration was that these were outside infiltrators. They liked that narrative because they can clear them off campus. In addition to the Emory police, which just do their normal thing, the Atlanta police was there. I came down just to check to see that they weren't calling in the police again. And as I stood there, the very heavy-handed Georgia state police marched in. In the moment they lined up, they just went in and started attacking the students and the demonstrators. There weren't that many of them, about 30 people. So it was terrible. And I stood in between, I stood and watched and videotaped them wailing on this one student on the ground, and they asked them to stop, and then they arrested me.
They arrested you. Is it just a case of bad policing, or was it a deliberate tactic?
Well, I don't think they realized that they were going to round up professors as well as students. I think they had very bad intelligence. They weren't really looking for good intelligence to know that there was mostly Emory people. Students there, excuse me. So they ended up arresting three faculty members as well.
Tell us about who those students are, what their makeup is.
There are a range of students, undergraduates, graduate students. But let me tell you, I think you talked at the beginning about generation gap. I just left to come over here, a demonstration of faculty members in solidarity with the students. So it's not a generation gap. It's a gap in higher education between the administrators and the faculty. It's a gap between those who are supposed to make something run on time and those who are in the business of educating. The educators and the students are really working together. If we had more space for thinking and deliberation, we'd have a better politics. Right now we have a politics that doesn't really allow for much space for that.
Those students, one of their big demands is divestment from companies that do business with Israel and its defense forces after 6 months of war in Gaza. Is that spooking an administration whose job is to raise money for your university?
Well, not this. When I was in college, we did the exact same thing to get our universities to divest from the apartheid regime in South Africa. We were considered radicals. People were arrested. This is the same thing. And now people are so happy that we divested from South Africa, the regime that was there at that time. So I see the students acting on conscience for the same thing. It's against a particular conservative political regime. It's not against the people of Israel. It's not against, and it's a lot of Jewish students here are getting worried that this is anti-Semitic. It's a very clear distinction between a particular kind of government and any particular faith or religion.
Yasha Monk, you're in New York City ahead of a fresh ultimatum there by the administration at Columbia University for the encampment to be cleared at 2 p.m. Local time. Do you agree with what you heard there from Noel McAfee?
Yes and no. I'm not president of Columbia University. I don't know exactly what the situation is there on campus beyond the press reports. But we've clearly seen a mix of two different things. One is a protest movement that is legitimate, whether or not you agree with it. It is perfectly appropriate for university students to make their voices heard, to protest in favor of a course that they find to be important. And I think one of the problems at American universities for a long time has been overly strict limitations on free expression and free speech, limitations that often has been cheered on not just by administrators, but also by many faculty members. And we need to stand up very clearly for free speech.
When you say limitations on free speech, what do you mean?
Well, I'm talking about a whole apparatus of DEI that has started to put under disciplinary consequences form of free speech. So one example is that at New York University, for example, there are now free numbers on the ID card that students are issued with, the first to call in case of medical emergencies, the second in case there's an emergency on campus, for example, because there's an active shooter or some kind of physical threat, and the third to call if there is a perceived microaggression, and then a bias response team is going to come and investigate this supposed microaggression, potentially disciplining students for things they said to each other in some kind of context. So the university has sent for a very long time the message that anything that might be considered offensive, anything that might make people feel uncomfortable, is going to have this concerted administrative response. This has led to some tensions in the last months on campus because many Jewish students who have been trained in this kind of context have then understandably said, well, why is it that any phrase that might be considered offensive when said, in relation to 17 other groups is perfectly acceptable in the case of my group? Why is it that we aren't being protected from offensive speech in the same kind of way? And here it must be said that the legitimate protests that we've seen at universities have often turned into something that goes well beyond that. We have seen Jewish students attacked at many American universities. We have seen clearly anti-Semitic statements like protesters shouting at Jewish students they should go back to Poland. And that is a very clear element of these protests as well. Now, I personally think that we need to put up with a very far-reaching conception of freedom of speech. But universities have been very hypocritical on this, protecting some students from supposedly offensive speech and not others. And that is part of what has led to these tensions on campus and what has led to outside interest in what's going on campus from Congress and other sources.
Gregory Smith-Simon, what's it been like at Brooklyn College?
Well, it's interesting. That's another campus in New York, but not an elite one. You have a very diverse student body there, and students have been involved from the very beginning, led actually by the Puerto Rican Student Alliance. So you have a different sort of mix at some of the public universities and a sense of the way that this does represent, I think, a political realignment you're seeing a significant part of the American left for the first time openly critical of Israeli policy towards Palestinians, sort of in the way that you saw division in recent years on the American right, a significant portion not concerned about Russian expansionism, that these represent international issues that were sources of unity across the political spectrum and are not now.
And further to what Yasha was saying about how, has it become harder to disagree in the era of safe spaces and trigger warnings?
You know, it's funny. At a place like Brooklyn, you have to take a subway for about 2 hours through New York City to get to campus. If you can make it through that, you'll make it through anything. So I don't find that my students are unduly sensitive. They want to be respected. I've seen less of a connection to the sort of woke movement on campus, and with these protests, more of a lineage towards Black Lives Matter. Students in during those protests in 2020 were making some explicit connections between the U.S. civil rights movement and the concerns of African Americans and the demands of Palestinians. You also saw students talking about defunding the police, and I think in some ways that's led them to think about U.S. funding for international operations in a way that perhaps they might not have before.
Annette Lévy-Villard, what's going on the U.S. campuses? You heard the comparison earlier from Noah McCaffrey with the call to divest from South Africa in the 1980s. Is it like that? Is it like what happened in the 1960s?
No, I mean, I have the feeling that people, well, I was in America in the 70s too, when there were still, big demonstrations and very much political mobilization. But here I have the feeling that people really don't really know a lot about the Middle East. They react in a very, I mean, tell me if I'm wrong, they react in a very emotional way. You know, you see the Palestinians being bombed in Gaza by the strong Israeli army. I mean, you know, David and Goliath, and they react in a very, this is what I have been hearing from all of my friends on American campuses. It's an emotional thing, it's not a rational thing. South Africa was more clear. I mean, it was really, you know, apartheid was a real thing. Here it's much more complicated, as you know. Gaza is a very complex thing.
Is it complicated because you're from an older generation? Is it less complicated if you're from a younger generation? I ask the question because when you're from younger generation, you're judging on the images, the facts that you see, whereas the older generation knows about the baggage of how the state of Israel was created, of what preceded it with the...
I'm not sure because, you know, if you go back to May 68, I was in Nanterre, I mean, where it all started. We were fighting against the French society. I mean, it was kind of clear, you know, the old conservative France under General de Gaulle. I mean, it's kind of rather clear.
There was a real generation gap then.
Yes, and here I think that just supporting Palestine is, to me, is not that easy because the situation is much more complicated. When I saw it on the streets of Paris, you had a big, lot of feminist marches for feminist issues. And I saw a big slogan, lesbians for Palestine, lesbians. And I could connect, maybe I'm the old generation, and we started the women's movement in France. I couldn't connect the lesbian cause to the Palestinian cause. I didn't see the direct connection, you know. So I think things are more subtle than just marching against the war in Vietnam. Like, we all marched, my generation, against the war in Vietnam, whether it was in America, all over Europe, all over the world. It was kind of clear. And that's not that easy, I think.
No, Noah McCaffrey, do you take that point that... this is less clear-cut than it was with whether or not the U.S. should be in Vietnam and whether or not you were supporting the apartheid regime in South Africa.
I think this is more like the South Africa. There's a different kind of revolution against cultural norms and all of it. The student movement against apartheid was very clear. It was well-organized. It had a clear solution, which was to divest. So, again, I would just reject the whole generational divide thing because out there. The demonstration was faculty members like me calling for supporting the students' demonstrations. And it's not so much around a particular issue. It's also about academic freedom, social justice more broadly. I think these students are very clear-eyed and rational and passionate. I don't think there's a passion versus reason dichotomy that makes any sense.
All right. The call that what has inflamed, you could say, America has been the fact that the police went onto the campus of Columbia University for the first time since the Vietnam War. It came at the request of the president of the university. This is on the evening of April the 18th. They made more than 100 arrests, dismantling the encampment on campus, which was then re-erected. The movement snowballing. Last week, France 24 correspondent Jessica Le Mesurier went to Columbia, spoke with a 26-year-old master's degree student.
I think our positionality here as students in the United States, where the United States is one of the largest funders of Israel, one of the largest funders of the genocide happening in Palestine, we sit in the country that not only funds but also manufactures and creates a lot of the bombs dropping on Gaza. Every piece of the weaponry that allows this genocide to continue is being funded actively by universities like Columbia through their endowments. So the student movement today is actually building off of the student movement from the 1960s here in the US and globally, the 1980s against apartheid South Africa. And today we're seeing another spark in the student movement.
Yasha Monk, your thoughts on what is a straightforward case there made?
Well, I'm really not here to debate the broader issue. I think the interesting question about universities is how to live up to their substantial principles. And I think they need to combine two different imperatives there. The first is to actually stand up for free speech. And as I was saying, universities have failed at that in a much broader way over the last 10 and 20 years. And they need to recommit themselves to ensuring that students, faculty members, protesters, can express themselves in ways that might make other students uncomfortable. That is part of what academic freedom must mean. The second part, of course, is that one element of the enforcement of free speech norms has always been that you cannot allow the heckler's veto, that you cannot allow physical disruption of the speech of others and of a core functioning of the university. So it is one thing for me, for example, to protest a visiting speaker very robustly in front of an event space. It is another to stop attendees from gaining access to that event space. It is another thing to stand up in the middle of the event and shout down the speaker in such a way that the event can't go forward. That is not an exercise of free speech. That is an exercise of a heckler's veto that makes free speech impossible for other members of a community. So the very hard choice that university leaders have to make at the moment is how to stand up for free speech, which necessitates enforcing some of those rules, and it's clear that protesters have been breaking those rules, but in a way that is proportionate, in a way that doesn't unduly punish students who perhaps are breaking the rules of the university, but in the pursuit of their political causes. And that is a very hard balance to strike. I think that university presidents haven't done very well at doing that, but that is partially because we've allowed the broader culture of what free speech and academic freedom must mean to wither on the vine for a long time. Now, I think the question that all sensible faculty members and philosophers and theorists like myself should ask ourselves is, well, under what circumstances is it legitimate for university leaders to break up protests that clearly break current rules? And under what circumstances might it even be permissible to call in the police? The answer is clearly not going to be never. The answer may very well be that the circumstances we saw at Columbia University and other places did not yet justify that kind of intervention. But unless we're able to articulate a principled answer to that question, we're not actually thinking through the case. We're simply engaged in special pleading, depending on which political causes we like or which political causes we dislike.
So cynics would argue, Gregory Smith-Simon, that graduation day at Columbia University is May 15th. And graduation in America is a big thing, right? You have the big donors who come back to campus, if they're alumni and stuff, and that you don't want to have an encampment on graduation day. Is that what this is all about?
That's very much on the administration's minds. I'm surprised that the University of Southern California has already canceled their graduation, but the letter that Columbia distributed to protesting and occupying students today made explicit reference to graduation and even pointed out that a lot of the students graduating today didn't get an American-style high school graduation because of COVID and encouraged the students to disperse. All the more surprising that USC has done that, as you said.
It's not, UCLA, I thought.
It's not just a moment for students, but as you said, for alumni to come and make donations. I think one of the things that's very peculiar is the inconsistency, as the other guest was saying, about how the administrations have dealt with it. If you look back, not even as far as apartheid or 1968, but to protests in the 2000s, during the Afghan War, students sat in for several days on campuses without arrest. The University of Pennsylvania, students were there for 2 weeks on a labor issue occupying the president's office, and there are no arrests. Harvard students were sitting in the early 2000s about the pay of janitors and other workers on staff. So there's something different about the administration's response this time that's not consistent.
Annette Levy-Villard, you're a former Israel correspondent.
Yes.
What is it about the Middle East? It's the political third rail, isn't it? That's what the answer to Gregory Smith's question.
And I was thinking,
you can protest about Afghanistan.
I was listening to this reference to South Africa, apartheid, everything. Mandela, the Hamas is not Mandela. Let's see. It cannot be compared to what we fought for.
But it's always fraught, is my question. It's always, whenever we talk about the Middle East, they have to always tread very, very carefully.
Because it's a complex situation, the Middle East. I mean, it cannot be. I mean, South Africa was so clear. I mean, you remember, and even Afghanistan, it was clear that the American soldiers didn't have to be in Afghanistan, didn't make any sense. I mean, then, you know, I mean, unfortunately, it would have been better to stay there. But okay. And in that case, you have nobody talks about the Hamas. I mean, like you listen to these students, they forget about the Hamas. But you have a Palestinian flag, and who is fighting for Palestine today is the Hamas. And nobody talks about who is the Hamas. And that's part of the problem, you know.
I think that's, to understand what the students are doing, the Afghanistan comparison is important. No one thought that when the students were protesting the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, they supported the Taliban. They didn't. They opposed the U.S. invasion and occupation. In the same way, I don't think there's any evidence that the students who are doing the occupying have evaluated and decided that they're more pro-Hamas than Fatah. They're opposed to the invasion and the occupation. So I think in that sense, the Afghanistan example gives a clearer sense of what the students are for and what they're not opposed than the apartheid example.
All right, so unfortunately, that is simply too simple when you look at the details of these protests. It's very clear, for example, that Students for Justice in Palestine have celebrated the October 7th attack in many of their chapters, and they are, in fact, leading the protests at Columbia University and other places. So while it's certainly true that many of the students who are protesting oppose the Israeli military action in Gaza while recognizing Israel's state right to exist and while condemning the terrible atrocities committed by Hamas, it is quite clearly untrue of significant portions of that protest movement, including their leaders. And I don't think we're doing anybody a service if we pretend that those elements aren't part of this protest movement for political convenience.
How do you measure this, Yasha? How do you do it so that you're not tarring everyone with the same brushstroke?
Well, again, if formally some of the organizations that are actually leading these protest movements issued statements on October 8th and October 9th celebrating the Hamas terror attack on civilians in the south of Israel as a glorious form of resistance and a form of intifada that should be celebrated, I think that's pretty clear. Again, I'm not saying that that is all students who are participating in this protest, perhaps it's not most students who are participating in this protest, but to say that all protesters, as the previous speaker did, are clearly distinguishing between the opposition to Israeli military action in Gaza, that I also view critically, much more extreme positions up to and including explicit support for Hamas, I simply think that there's very clear evidence contradicting.
I think we need a political culture so that we don't have this polarization and this kind of paranoid politics. I think most people are reasonable and are not making the equations that the speaker just said. It's just not happening here. I don't see it at all.
But we had, for instance, all right, let me put this to you then, Noel McAfee. At Emory University, the day that last Thursday, when there were those arrests, including you, there was one chant which was KKK IDF, you're all the same, likening the Israeli Defense Forces, which are the army that protects a country, to the Ku Klux Klan, a white nationalist paramilitary organization, if you will, or. You can understand how that shocks a lot of people.
They took some poetic license, but I don't completely disagree with
it. Annette Lévy-Villard?
Okay, well, this is not really, from a philosophical point, it does not make sense. You cannot compare two things which cannot be compared. The extreme right KKK with the history of the South and a war which has been going on since 1948 between Israel and its neighbors, you know, war with between Israel and Lebanon, between Israel and Egypt. I mean, it has no connection, so you cannot compare things which are not the same. It does not. I mean, from a historical point, it has no connection.
I'll defer to your expertise, but there have been different political regimes in Israel, and the current one is very far right.
I think one of the interesting things in terms of the student protest, as you and your listeners probably know, is that while France has rules that can penalize groups for, say, making apologies for terrorism, the U.S. right to free speech is very extensive. So the discussion we're having now, you know, comparing the IDF to the KKK or expressing support for Hamas actually should not have any effect on the protesters' right to assemble. In right. the U.S., you do have a right to do that. So even outside the debate of whether these comparisons are apt or not, the university's response being different isn't justified by that.
All right, but I want to get to how these are viewed on this side of the Atlantic, but first, just the politics of it all, the domestic U.S. politics of it all. The closer to graduation, the bigger the headache for the university. The closer to Election Day, the bigger the headache for the Democrats and the incumbent president. Protesters Saturday heckling participants in the White House Correspondents' Dinner. For the Republicans, well, there are no such divisions, it seems. Last Wednesday, the Speaker of the House of Representatives went to the campus of Columbia University.
Today, Hamas issued an endorsement statement of the protesters on this campus. They call them the future leaders of America. All of this has to be said because the cherished traditions of this university are being overtaken right now by radical, extreme ideology. They place a target on the backs of Jewish students.
So, Noel McAfee, you're saying it's not so much what the current movement like the Vietnam War, but is it like it in the sense that this is going to divide the left in the U.S. for a long time?
We need, my other work is as a political philosopher, and I strongly believe we need to find spaces to talk across, to find, but what happened on Thursday was that the administration, I now know, had thought that this was outside agitators, and they didn't talk to any of the people who were on the quad. They didn't go over and talk to them and say, who are you? Oh, you're a student here. They didn't find out that these were students who had concerns, and they weren't ideologues. There were people milling around. It was a kind of a party atmosphere. It was pleasant, and they didn't talk to people. That's like the police, the administration didn't talk to people. They didn't say, oh, you know, in a week there's a commencement. Can you maybe go somewhere else? We'll find a nice, comfortable place. There was no conversation at all. Jumping into most extreme reaction.
Gregory Smith-Simon, are there going to be consequences on the U.S. elections?
I think there could be. Obviously, the election is in November, quite a ways off from now, and it's hard to imagine that the crisis in Gaza will continue in the same way until then. However, college students typically make up a really important part of a presidential campaign. They're sort of the foot soldiers who are going out getting voters to get to the polls in the swing states. So that's going to cause a problem if these students don't get involved in the Democratic Party. And Johnson, in a lot of ways, is right. Columbia's had presidents affiliated from Eisenhower to Obama. When you see these kinds of shifts on college campuses, you can expect that they're going to have repercussions in the larger public political debate for years to come.
Now, the protests in the U.S. have inspired protests here. Police this Monday going into the main courtyard of Paris's Sorbonne University to break up a burgeoning encampment. Those are cobblestones, yes. This after last Friday, when students at the elite political science institute Sciences Po lifted their blockade on the heels of negotiations with the administration. Sciences Po, whose alums include President Macron and his prime minister, Gabriel Attal.
I had the occasion a few weeks ago, you'll recall, to go to Sciences Po before the board of directors to denounce the excesses of an active and dangerous minority that wants to impose on the majority of students and teachers an ideology imported from across the Atlantic and that tries to disrupt the proper functioning of this school, which is, of course, an important school for our country. And I repeat it here. We never waver on the respect of the law and the respect of the values of the Republic.
Is it an ideology imported from across the Atlantic, Annette Lévy-Villard?
Well, you know that Sciences Po has a lot of relationship, of connections with Columbia University. I mean, they have exchanged programs and by
But it sounds a bit like outside infiltrators coming in.
No, but I mean, they are definitely under the influence of what's happening in Colombia. I mean, they are very close to Columbia University. But I mean, Sciences Po has
And when he says this is a very important school for our country?
Sciences Po, Colombia.
Yes. No, it's Sciences Po. He's talking about Sciences Po, the prime minister.
I mean, they have been all the government. All the political staff in this country, in France, has been studying at Sciences Po at one point. I mean, it is the elite of the elite school. But Sciences Po has always been very sensitive to the woke ideas. You know, there had been a lot of intellectual debates imported from America, the wokeism, you know, on gender, anti-colonialism. And so Sciences Po had been very open to this kind of debate. I'm not surprised.
You were talking about Black Lives Matter earlier in the conversation, Gregory Smith-Simon. The same conversations are now happening all over the world?
They are in different ways. There's an anti-police violence movement in France, but it is framed differently than Black Lives Matter is. I think in the same way, it's been interesting to see the broad attack against something imagined as wokeism in France, which is in some ways a cost-free opportunity for politicians to denounce something as foreign and American rather than talking about what's going on in the U.S. I think, you know, the presence, for instance, of feminists at some of the anti-racist and anti-Islamophobic marches ties to the idea that a lot of times the argument against some of these organizations, some of the pro-Palestinian movements, is that the Arab world is somehow more patriarchal and not feminist and that feminists should stay away. The marches that I observed while we're here worked with feminist groups so that they could explicitly say that there are feminists who are supporting this. So that is to say that you have the same mix of issues in the U.S. and France, but that they come out quite differently. You've got different histories here and different sorts of battles.
Yascha Mounk, what about in your native Germany? How's it going with young people as far as the last 6 months have gone and what's been unfolding since April 18th?
Well, I think one of the things that's important in the American context, in the French context, and in the German context is to distinguish between the causes that lead to strong political engagement among activist young people and the opinions of the majority of people in that age group. When you look at French polls, for example, young people are more, not less likely than middle-aged people to vote for Marine Le Pen. When you look at the last elections in Germany, young people were actually roughly politically balanced with other age groups and perhaps a smidgen to the right of older age groups. And in the United States, young people are more to the left than older people for a variety of reasons. But the average young person is politically moderate, says that their main political concerns are the same political concerns as the majority of the population, which is currently inflation and immigration, and have a much more balanced view on the Israel-Palestine conflict as well. In fact, when you're trying to think through what's going to happen come November and the American presidential elections, the biggest challenge for Democrats at the moment is that the demographic groups of which they assumed that they would be able to profit on them to drive home a victory, which is young people, but also non-white voters, Latino voters, for example, are voting for Republicans in much greater numbers than there were 4 or 8 years ago. So I think it's important to be subtle here in our distinction between what are the political causes that are driving activist young people at elite institutions like Columbia University or some of those French institutions you mentioned. And is that going to create a problem for Democrats because it splits their coalition and perhaps it means that not as many people are going to go door-to-door knocking and engaging in activism for the political party? I think all of that is true. And what, more broadly speaking, is the opinion of young people, is the opinion of those rising demographic groups in the electorate? And that question is much more complicated, much more subtle. Those groups are much less progressive on this issue, but also on other issues than the media that tends to focus on those elite institutions tends to assume.
And why is that?
Well, that has different kinds of causes. I think in the case of the United States, the assumption has been in particular that non-white voter groups are well represented by the spokespeople for them in the media and the spokespeople for them on elite college campuses. But actually, the values are rather different. They care most, like most voters, about the state of the economy and about making sure that they have concrete economic opportunities for their own families. But they also often come from much more socially conservative backgrounds than the elite culture that has taken over at the big universities and that is represented in the mainstream media. And so they feel that Democrats are engaged in a form of what Bill Clinton's campaign advisor has called faculty lounge politics, in which they, speak the language that all of us on this panel are comfortable with, the language of the university, the language of graduate school, in which they condemn ordinary voters when they use the wrong term, when they express themselves in some way inartfully, that they have turned against basic, quote-unquote, bourgeois values that are actually very common among non-white voter groups, like caring a lot about the nuclear family, about those kinds of concerns. And so they increasingly feel that, those parts of the political spectrum don't really speak for them. Another way of putting this is what the French economist Thomas Piketty has noted about the fact that much of the left has turned into a Brahmin left, one that is actually much more popular, has much more support among the affluent and highly educated, rather than the segments of a population that the left has traditionally represented, namely those who are less affluent and perhaps also, on average, less educated.
And we're seeing the live images there, aerial shots of Columbia University ahead of that latest ultimatum to leave to break up their encampment for some 10 minutes time from now. Annette Lévy-Villard.
Yeah, I wanted just to add something about elections. I have been covered most of the presidential elections in America, and it's clear that the elections are never based on international issues. It's always on home issues, So even if Palestine seems to be a big issue today, in November, people won't vote on an issue like Palestine. The same with European elections coming for us in June, soon. All the polls show that if you ask people what is going to be important for their vote, and Palestine, for instance, comes, like at the bottom, number 10 or 12, whatever. People actually keep voting for home issues, for direct
issues. For more bread and butter issues. Noah McAfee, something Yascha Mounk said, I want your experience on this, which is how your students inform themselves. They obviously don't sit down and or maybe they do watch the evening news, or do they watch debate programs like this one?
You know, my students are, we have very good admissions and financial aid. So we have a lot of first generation students and support for them. We have a very diverse campus. So you see an array of students, not just the elite ones at all. I think they get their news through social media, through the New York Times, through largely the same media I get, the local news. So they're very well educated. They're very savvy, and I don't see them falling into kind of identity politics. This generation seems to be truly more publicly engaged, and I find that I wish we had more spaces where we could talk through things and become more nuanced and deal with shades of gray, because when there's no time, the police are coming to drag you away. It's just about the middle moment, the little sound bites, which is not conducive to a healthy thought.
So we need more of what Yasha Monk was arguing for at the beginning of the show, the possibility to confront ideas that it's less common than before. You agree with him on that point?
I'm not sure if it's ever been very common, but I think students now are really hungry for something like that, and there's very little space to do something beyond chant. That's why I wasn't participating in the protest. I just came, and then I tried to protect a protester from being pummeled to death.
Gregory Smith-Simon?
I think the point is well made that these, large student protests don't translate into electoral changes. 1968 was a big protest year in the U.S., and Republican Richard Nixon was the winner of the election that year. I think that what you do see is a realignment politically, and you're seeing that happening in real time on the left. One of the things that's different about these protests in terms of media is students' use of social media. For a long time, it was striking how isolated different campuses were. Even when there were protests on the same issue in different places, there's very little real-time communication among protesters at one campus and another. Now, in particular, with Instagram and other sorts of social media, they're seeing updates in real time, both about student strategies and the university's responses. That's created a sort of networked response and a rapidity that we haven't seen in other protests. And so this realignment, I think, is spreading more quickly than perhaps it did in other eras when it was limited to a smaller number of campuses.
Annette Lévy-Villard, a final word on this, and the fact that you have the head of the LFE parliamentary group, which on Tuesday is being hauled in before investigating magistrates for an apology of terrorism probe. They had put out a statement on October 7th that sparked controversy, describing Hamas attack as an armed offensive by Palestinian forces.
Right.
And there are people who disagree with that statement, but who say you shouldn't be hauling in.
Well, there are laws, so people can sue politicians for, apology of terrorism or denial of the Holocaust, of talking about genocide. I mean, these are French laws. I mean, you can sue people for that. But if you ask me what I think of it, I think I'm for free speech as long as you don't have a hate speech, as long as you don't call for violence, And so Mathilde Panot, which is the head of La France Insoumise, which is the extreme left, has been talking about genocide, like Jean-Luc Mélenchon. They have not called, more or less, the Hamas a terrorist organization, which it is. But in my opinion, and I'm going to follow what I just heard, we need debates, and I think it's very much true for the American students rebelling today. They would need debates and talking about exactly what it's all about. And Sciences Po, there's going to be a huge debate next week, too, that part of the negotiation between the administration and the students. And that's good. I think people should talk and learn. And I don't believe that the information, especially in America, because I know the American students, they don't know enough about international issues.
We're all for debates here at France 24. Annette Lévy-Villard, I want to thank you so much. I want to thank Gregory Smith-Simon, Yasha Monk for being with us from New York City, Noah McAfee from Atlanta. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.